Some of this work was done simply because he had needed the money, and some of it because he had felt a burning desire to speak his mind. But he was also doing what all ambitious writers, rich or poor, do. He was promoting his career by keeping his name in print in as many places as possible. He drove himself relentlessly to make his mark as a writer, yet he was always doubting whether he'd done enough to earn a respectable reputation, or even whether a respectable reputation was worth achieving. Of course, his behaviour is contradictory, but he thrived on contradiction. It is everywhere in his life and work. He called himself a socialist, yet he was always pointing out weaknesses in socialism. He devoted enormous effort to writing his novels, yet admitted near the end of his life, "I'm not a real novelist anyway." He was an intellectual who ran a small village shop and referred to himself as a grocer, an ex-policeman who lived among tramps, an inveterate reviewer who complained that reviewing damaged a writer's soul. He liked to expose flaws in the works of great writers and to praise signs of greatness in the works of minor ones. He had a keen appetite for a literary contradiction that he called, borrowing the phrase from G.K. Chesterton, the good-bad book. Whatever the subject, Orwell was always tempted to look at it from both sides, and when he considered another point of view, he did not usually do it half-heartedly. He became immersed in it and used all the powers of his imagination to identify with it. This ability allowed him to see what others ignored and to challenge comfortable assumptions. It is one of the sources of his greatness as a writer. But it also helps to explain why, whenever he turned a critical eye on his own work, he had no trouble finding faults and imagining the worst about his career. He wrote in a style that seems plain at first glance, but that is in fact the product of a highly sophisticated artistic process. Anyone who doubts this sophistication should try imitating his style for a page or two. At his best, he makes writing look easy, but no one should underestimate his mastery of English prose. He loved the sound of mere words, and cultivated his style with devotion. Language was one of the things that made life worth living. "So long as I remain alive and well," he said in Why I Write, "I shall continue to feel strongly about prose style, to love the surface of the earth, and to take pleasure in solid objects and scraps of useless information." Lionel Trilling was wrong when he praised Orwell's plainness as an example of what ordinary writers could achieve if they tried to do their best. "He is not a genius. What a relief," Trilling said of Orwell. It is true that Orwell was not a great novelist, but it is a mistake to deny his genius as a prose stylist. In his large body of work, 13 books and hundreds of essays and reviews, he created a literary voice that is one of the most compelling in the history of English prose. He demands to be read. There is no one else like him. The rich complexity of his character makes him a fascinating subject for a biography, but he was opposed to the idea and said so in his will. He gave no reason. His widow, Sonia, who had married him only 3 months before his death and who was 15 years his junior, had her opinions, one of which was, "He believed there is nothing about a writer's life that is relevant to a judgment of his work." He thought that a writer's aesthetic merits and moral behaviour should be judged separately, as he explained in an essay on Salvador Dali. "One ought to be able to hold in one's head simultaneously the two facts that Dali is a good draftsman and a disgusting human being. The one does not invalidate or, in a sense, affect the other. But this does not mean that biography, even when it reveals intimate details of personal problems, is irrelevant to an understanding of a writer's work." In 1944, reviewing a new biography of Baudelaire, Orwell complained, "What is one to think of a life of Baudelaire which never once mentions that Baudelaire was syphilitic? This is not merely a piece of scandal, it is a point upon which any biographer of Baudelaire must make up his mind. The nature of the disease has a bearing not only on the poet's mental condition during his last year, but on his whole attitude to life." It is easy to make such an argument about another writer's biography, but one's own life is a different matter. Orwell was a private man, and the thought of a biographer digging into his past would not have pleased him. He was probably convinced also that no biographer would understand him and would convey a misleading impression to readers. He knew how critical he could be of himself, and he could well imagine the extent to which an unsympathetic biographer might twist facts. Even a sympathetic one would have some disturbing private details to reveal, if the research were done honestly and thoroughly. In the 1940s, Orwell told his young housekeeper, Susan Watson, that he was the only person who could do the story of his life properly, but that he would never attempt it because, as he explained it to her, in an autobiography you had to tell the whole truth. And the truth must sting. Autobiography is only to be trusted when it reveals something disgraceful, Orwell wrote in his essay on Dali. Whether certain facts sting or not, the story of his life deserves to be told with as much accuracy and fairness as possible. His life matters because his work matters, and there is no point in pretending that the two things are unconnected. Books are not written by machines in sealed compartments. The writer's character and personal history influence what he writes and how he writes it, and the more we know about him, the better we are able to appreciate his work. No biography of Orwell would be necessary if his worst fears of failure had been realized. Instead, he succeeded beyond anything he could imagine, and the continuing growth of his fame is one justification for this book.